This is an ABC podcast.
You're the Prime Minister. What's your first move? Make Australia a green energy superpower. Fix the housing crisis. Treat mental health as a national priority. The economy, stupid, is talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy, Stupid, and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. If you have young teens in your life, one story has dominated this year: Australia's social media ban for under 16-year-olds. We've debated whether it was good for teens' mental health, whether tech companies would even comply, and there's a fair bit we still don't know about those questions, but the time is here. The legislation comes into effect tomorrow. You're about to hear from the eSafety Commissioner on what to expect, and later in the show, you'll hear from a parenting psychologist and a tech reporter with tips on how to navigate what comes next, not just for parents, but for all of us as internet users. Also ahead, you've been saving all year, you're about to go on holiday with your favourite people, but what happens when your travelling companions have a different idea about the kind of fun they want to have? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. Facebook, Snapchat, TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, from tomorrow morning, they're off limits if you're under 16. And adults won't be unaffected either. You'll have to verify your age to stay on. So what will this mean for you? You're about to hear from Australian eSafety Commissioner Julie Inman-Grant, who is leading the crackdown, but I really want you to be part of the conversation this morning. Julie Inman-Grant, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you. I've got three teenagers sleeping upstairs who haven't raised their heads yet. So,
well, if they wake up and they've got a question for you, chuck them on the phone, hey?
Yeah, absolutely.
What kind of conversations have you been having in your home about this year?
Well, I've got a little bit of a laboratory here to kind of, I guess, gauge the entire national sentiment. I have an older teenager who said, why wasn't this in place when I was struggling all those years and coming up against bullying and having all these unrealistic expectations? And I have boy, girl, 13-year-old twins. And so they're right in the sweet spot. They've just gotten used to using social media on a regular basis after saying that they were the only kids in the entire country who didn't have a smartphone. My son's pretty unfazed, but it's really distressing for my 13-year-old daughter, who feels like she's built her social life and a lot of her world around social media. And I think this will probably be representative of the broader population in that some kids will struggle with the transition and some will do so more seamlessly. And part of that has to do with the parental scaffolding and support we provide, but also the strategies that they undertake to prepare for this, doing things like making sure that they're setting up group messenger or WhatsApp chats with friends or exchanging phone numbers. I was asked yesterday if it was too insurmountable for kids to share phone numbers because they didn't know them. And I didn't think that that was probably something that they couldn't overcome.
I think I could still rattle off some of my best friend's phone numbers from when I was a young teenager.
Well, I mean, we have been made dumber, haven't we? Because we just program numbers into our phones. So we're not forced to remember numbers like we used to.
I do want to talk a bit about the logistics of the ban. It's been a really big, long run-up. There's been a lot of questions along the way. What happens at midnight? Do you have a great big red button on your desk that you just like push?
Oh, that would be so cool if I had a big red button, but I don't. So the way that the legislation was set up, it puts the burden on the platforms themselves to take reasonable steps. And when we developed the regulatory guidance, I did not presume that I would understand the company's technical infrastructure or user base better than they would. But what I have done is I've delved really deeply with all of them to understand what kind of age inference tools they're using now, what kind of AI tools. And then, of course, the government tested 50 different age assurance technologies through an age assurance technical trial. And, the overall finding was that the industry and the technologies have matured enough so that they are operational. About a third of them received the highest technical readiness level. And it was not only tested for accuracy, efficacy, and robustness, but also to ensure that it was privacy preserving. So when the company said to me earlier this year, oh, the technologies don't exist to do this. And I said, well, you're targeting me with deadly precision. Just when I physically looked at a dress at a store and somehow it popped up on my Facebook feed, I'm sure you can do this. But it's not going to be without its teething problems. I do believe they have the capability. I've been saying it too much, but they do, and they can. How well they execute in the initial days and weeks will be interesting and telling. But the way that my powers kick in tomorrow, I will have information gathering powers. Well, I will be able to ask them a series of questions on December 11th, like how many accounts of under 16s that you've identified did you deactivate? How many times have people tried to get around the system and been successful? How many times have they created fake or imposter accounts on the same device? How many have tried circumvention through VPNs or age spoofing around the age assurance systems? So I expect that all of these things will happen because teenagers are extremely clever and they're ingenuitive, and that gives me great comfort because they will be the leaders of tomorrow. But we've got to focus on the longer game and hold the course. That's what I've said to my team. People seem to want to tear down the idea, but most parents think it's a great idea and they want the support of the government here. And a lot of teenagers we've engaged with say, well, yeah, I mean, I don't want the FOMO. And if I'm not the only under 16 that doesn't have social media and my friends aren't supposed to have it too, I feel better about not having to constantly scroll or constantly keep up and create this rock star confected version of myself.
You are listening to Life Matters. Yeah, absolutely. You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, chatting with Julie Inman-Grant, our eSafety Commissioner here in Australia, about the social media ban for under 16-year-olds that comes into effect tomorrow. What do you want to know about the ban that comes into effect tomorrow? On the text line, there's a lot of questions about safety and privacy. One person says Medicare holds most people's date of birth. Did you consider a government statement based on that as proof of age? It seems preferable to facial recognition scans that might be abused later, or the other hoops kids might have to jump through. Another person says, I want to know what the options are if you refuse to provide ID or your biometrics to large social media companies. I don't presently trust them with my personal data. Why would I give them more? And Will says, won't uploading identification documents onto third-party platforms cause a large and unjustifiable security risk to Australians? Doesn't this also undermine freedom of speech due to anonymity now being impossible? Do you really trust social media platforms with our data? Julie, what do you say to those concerns?
There were a lot of questions there. Should I take each one in turn?
If you like, yeah. I feel like there's a theme. There's themes there around anxieties about privacy.
Yeah. And this is why this is a really unique bill, in that there are two regulators involved, me on the safety side, but also the privacy commissioner, to ensure that all of these technologies are being implemented in a safe, privacy-preserving and secure way. And she will be able to take on these platforms if they're not doing that in that way. And I should note, like I said before, when we tested these 50 or so technologies as part of the government's age assurance technical trial, we looked at whether they did this in privacy preserving ways. And I guess what I would say is, I think this is kind of a sad state of affairs, but the horse is already bolted in terms of these companies having your data. I mean,
But then we're looking at giving them more.
No, we're not actually giving them more. That's not how the age assurance technologies work. And it depends on which one they're using, but nobody would accept that a biometric scan of your face would be stored somewhere and to create a honeypot. The way a lot of these technologies works is it takes an instantaneous scan of your face. It will say, give me a few minutes. It will go back and it will check the biometrics. And then they take essentially an encrypted hash of this. So every time, and it will be on your phone, and every time you try and enter, what it will ask you for is what they call a liveness test. And that's when you take a selfie. And that is to prove that the scan they have, that you are that person behind the screen. So these had to be done in privacy preserving and secure ways. And this is how they have evolved significantly over the past 2 or 3 years. I think the other thing that's important to note about the legislation itself, and this is reflected in the regulatory guidance, is that no Australian, particularly young people, can be compelled to provide their digital or government ID. That can be one of the methods, and you won't be surprised to know that for people of an older vintage, we've been doing 100 points of ID for years and years. Mm. So older people are generally more comfortable with that, but are really uncomfortable with the idea of scanning our face for biometrics. But the younger generations are much more comfortable because they've been opening up their Apple iPhones through facial analysis and taking selfies for their endless snap streaks. So this is something that they're comfortable doing. It's going to depend on person to person, and this is why we've said to the platforms, you need to give users choice. So some of the platforms like TikTok has provided a third option, which is called parental vouching. Snap has also used a third option, working with an Australian technology called ConnectID.
Julie, I might just interrupt you just for a moment. We're just going to do some troubleshooting on your line. You sound a little bit like a robot, and we want you to be understood clearly. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking with Julie Inman-Grant, our eSafety Commissioner, about tomorrow's social media ban for under 16s coming into effect. It's something that we've spoken a lot about over the course of this year, and now it's social media ban eve. Your texts have been really informative to helping me sort of shape this conversation. One person is saying, I just want to say to Julie Inman-Grant, effing well done. Thank you so much. What a gutsy call, and I'm thrilled to live in this country that will have this ban. Thank you, thank you, thank you. So very warm praise there. Amanda says the under 16 social media ban won't just make the 16-year-olds prove their age, but everyone on social media in Australia to prove their age and risk their information to being put out there, which is what we were speaking about just before. Lucy Anam wants to know, how will you be supporting marginalised youth, whether it's socially marginalised or via geographic isolation, to remain connected to their support networks? Yes, there's bullying on social media, but often young people find their communities online, regional queer and trans youth, youth with disabilities, etc. This is a report, this sort of to speak to a report that came out earlier this week from QUT, featuring interviews with young people about the ban. Julie, what do you say about perhaps making teens more isolated?
That is an issue I raised early on before there was legislation even tabled. We, of course, do a lot of our own youth research and with vulnerable communities. And interestingly, what First Nations, kids with a disability, and LGBTQI plus kids have told us is that they feel more themselves online than they do in the real world. And it is a way to find their tribe. But they also experience disproportionate forms of online hate and targeted abuse because of who they are. Yet in many cases, they've decided they rather have that connection and just live with the abuse, which I think is a really sad trade-off. But so as a result of that, this is why Parliament decided to provide two exclusions in the legislation. So one is for messaging sites, and the other is for online gaming sites, where we have a lot of research that says there are some really positive aspects for online gaming. So, for instance, we gave this great NGO based out of Melbourne called Amaze that works with neurodivergent kids funding to write a guide on how to safely engage in online gaming for neurodivergent kids. So we've also put together a statement on children's digital rights and have made a commitment to trying to implement this in a way that we're ensuring that they can connect, communicate, and create. And can I just say that there are so many great NGOs from Project Rocket that works with young people to reach out to Headspace, to Kids Helpline. You know, they're preparing, they're hiring more people to make sure if kids are feeling distressed, they can talk to them. They have a great moderated social media site called The Circle that they're encouraging people to go. And then there are NGOs like Minus 18 who've set up a Discord communications mechanism for LGBTQI youth that want to reach out to others. So we've seen a lot of innovation in the youth sector and the mental health sector to try and help address some of these concerns so that kids can set up WhatsApp groups or Messenger groups or even do group chat on FaceTime.
Julie, I'm so conscious that we don't have much more time with you. There's a couple of things I really want to ask you about. Sure. One is that I know you've worked a lot with various social media companies over the course of the year, where I understand that X, formerly Twitter, is the only platform that hasn't publicly confirmed it will comply with the new laws. Can you confirm if that's true?
Well, I actually had a conversation with X a week or two ago, and they actually walked us through how they were going to comply. They haven't communicated to their user base, which is a bit disappointing because that is best practice. But it's actually been announced today that Reddit, who said that they didn't agree with it but would comply, has now filed a high court constitutional case in addition to the one by the New South Wales Libertarians. So, and again, Reddit has challenged the codes of the Irish Online Safety Commissioner. So this isn't totally unexpected.
What's Australia's power to compel the social platforms to conform to the rules?
So we've set out the reasonable steps, and what we'll be looking for is systemic non-compliance. So the companies that do absolutely nothing, or if they use a combination of technology, systems, and processes that seems to be consistently ineffective. So, you know, we can't expect that things are going to be instantaneously changed tomorrow. I think there will be a difference, but a lot of these companies have very complex systems. Their infrastructure is based in the US. It's going to take time for these to replicate through their systems. And they will get things wrong. But I think it's important that we as parents stay the course. We have the conversations with the kids. I mean, I sat down with my daughter in advance and we deleted her TikTok and Instagram together so she wouldn't have the anxiety of wondering tomorrow whether or not it would be deleted or not. We did that ourselves. And it's important to know that all of these platforms are required to have user reporting cues for parents or educators if a person is a young person is erroneously seen as underaged or their account hasn't disappeared.
Just finally,
so there are lots,
Julie,
of safeguards there.
Just finally, how will you measure success?
Well, I think there are a range of success metrics we're going to take in terms of, you know, the really granular KPIs or OKRs about how many of the known underage 16s accounts they've actually deleted, how much circumvention they have prevented. But we're doing a longitudinal evaluation to look at things over time. Are kids sleeping more? Are they interacting more? Are they out on the footy field? Are they reading books? Is their NAPLAN scores getting better? Are they taking fewer antidepressants? Are their, you know, phone bills less? We'll be looking at a whole range of factors to measure both the benefits, but also the unintended consequences.
Really looking forward to that data, Julie. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Julie Inman-Grant is the Australian eSafety Commissioner. The social media ban does come into effect here in Australia tomorrow for people under 16. We're going to keep talking about that this morning. Coming up next, a parenting psychologist and a tech reporter with some tips on how to navigate what comes next, not just for parents and teens, but for all of us as internet users.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
So we are, of course, chatting about Australia's social media ban for under 16-year-olds, which comes into effect tomorrow. You just heard from the eSafety Commissioner on how things will work. And if you didn't catch that whole chat, it will be on the ABC Listen app later this morning. Although a lot of parents are supportive of this move, as we just heard Julie Inman-Grant say before, doesn't mean it's going to be an easy transition. There's going to be a major adjustment for families, a lot to navigate, and it's going to affect all internet users for reasons that you will hear in a moment. But I do want to hear from you. If you're already navigating that move away from social media as a parent, I'd love to know how you're doing it. With me is Professor Alina Morovska from the Parenting and Family Support Centre at University of Queensland School of Psychology, and Cam Wilson, tech reporter at Crikey. Alina, I might start with you. Knowing teenagers and how they work, what's your impression of this new rule? How do you see it working?
Yeah, good morning, and delighted to be here. I think it's going to be a really interesting experiment, and you know, certainly kids are very creative, and I'm sure they'll find lots of different ways to subvert the system, but also to perhaps come up with new ways of interacting and engaging. So I'm sure there are adolescents out there who are feeling a lot of angst about what's going to happen and what the changes will mean for them, but there's probably also many who are thinking and being creative and innovative as well.
Experiment, innovative. It sounds very like, it sounds a little bit like spin, I feel like, with some of the conversations we're having here. But I guess it's a bit early for people to sort of know what to expect, Alina.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I say, you know, kids are trying to figure out ways around it, that's what I mean by experimental. You know, I was hearing from some of my own kids about what's happening out there in the world, and, you know, from VPNs as being one of the popular options to putting on appropriate levels of makeup for the girls to subvert the facial recognition. How effective that is, that's not my area of expertise. But these are the sorts of conversations kids are having. And so therefore, that's translating into the kinds of conversations that parents are having with their kids about what that means.
So, Cam, in your role as a tech reporter for Crikey, you've been following what kids have been doing. You've been talking to them about it. What kind of things are you hearing?
So we're seeing that kids are very eager to get around the ban. There was actually a listener or a watcher survey of ABC's BTN show, which is the news show for kids, which spoke to 17,000 kids, and I think 75% of them said that they were planning on getting around the ban in some way or another. We do know as well that, you know, a third of parents told a survey for the government that they're actually also planning on helping their kids get around it. So clearly there is some desire, some significant desire from the community to get around it. I do think that there is a question about how easy that will be to get around it. We are hearing, of course, about things like VPNs, things about kids wearing makeup or scrunching up their face to kind of, I think, simulate wrinkles and other things to get around the ban. And look, you know, it's kind of hard from just hearing anecdotal evidence to know how widespread it is. The thing that I would say is I think that, like, you know, there are a lot of methods to get around it. Some involve fooling technology systems. Some involve just going to alternative platforms, which I think is kind of very hard to stop. But, you know, with some of these tech systems that the platforms are relying on, I think fooling them might be a little bit harder sometimes than what people might expect. For example, you know, if you use a VPN, which people might not be familiar with, but the kind of basic understanding of it is it's a piece of software that allows you to pretend like you are somewhere else. And so it might say, you know, all of a sudden I might switch it on and I go from, you know, my computer says I'm in Australia and now I'm in Paraguay or something. But platforms can use a whole range of signals, including, well, like, where have you been in the past? What time are you logging on? Even the things that you're posting when you're like, you know, hey, just gone down to Bondi to figure out roughly where you are. So, you know, it is a little bit more complex than just simply, you know, switching on a VPN or even, you know, tricking the systems once, because, you know, the eSafety Commissioner was on before has told the platforms you've got to keep on evaluating these. They don't just get past the gate once and then they're in. But yes, there's clearly a lot of desire to get around it.
And the onus is on the platforms to be policing that, to be keeping the kids out.
Yeah, that's right. So it's on the platforms. They need to take what's called reasonable steps. And that is, there's some information about that, but that's largely left up to the platforms. And my understanding is it's going to be a kind of constant negotiation in response to how things are going. But yes, like children, parents, anyone who wants to get around it, there's no actual consequences for them to do so.
So Greens Senator Sarah Hanson-Young and others I've heard have voiced concerns that kids are going to end up in other online spaces that are, well, in her words, darker and more dangerous. How likely do you think that is?
So there's two ways in which that'll happen. The first way is that they go to alternative platforms, you know, the ones that have been coming up like CoverStar, Yopu, Emanate. You probably haven't heard of them. That's probably the point. Like, these are places that, you know, aren't as well established. And in many of those cases, they are not big companies. You know, Yopu, for example, doesn't even have any information on its platform about what it actually does just generally to keep its users safe. So, you know, it's pretty safe to assume that these other platforms will less scrutiny, with less users and resources, are probably doing less to keep users safe, and there is concern about that. And the other concern is that, you know, I know these platforms have a pretty bad reputation for failing to keep children safe online on their platforms for many years. Over the last few years, they kind of have implemented some features. You know, they do recognize who are teens, or they try to recognize who are teens, and then show them slightly different, more limited experiences online. You know, for example, some of them, you know, if you're 13 and you're on Instagram, when you're still allowed to, an adult can't actually message you directly, things like that. But if you're a teen who fools Instagram somehow into staying on your platform, you're going to now get that full adult experience without those protections. So, you know, there is that, you know, even if you stay in the major platforms, but convince them you're an adult, you're no longer getting these online safety features for kids that they've developed.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking to Cam Wilson, who's a tech reporter at Crikey, and Professor Alina Morovska, who is a parenting and family researcher at the University of Queensland, about how to navigate what's going to come after tomorrow when the social media ban for under 16s comes into place. I'm asking you about your questions, your thoughts on the ban. Rodney says most people forget that the most valuable personal possession is your privacy. To hand your private life to multinational corporations is to become the product. Will the more isolated young teens still be able to use Zoom or the Google equivalent to keep connected to their friends is a question that one person's saying. Zoom is not part of the ban as far as I know. Alina, one of the big drivers for the ban was concerns about youth mental health. How likely is it that social media, restricting social media, is going to help with youth mental health as far as you know?
Look, so there is some data suggesting that social media or excessive social media use or excessive screen use is associated with, lower mental health or difficulties with mental health. So I guess at a population level, at a public health level, if we have fewer kids on average engaging in excessive use, then that should make a difference to youth mental health. But that's at a population level. If you are looking at your own child, are you going to see much of a difference there? Perhaps not. It's a very, very individual, thing.
Has it become a bit of a scapegoat for things like body image issues or mental health? Are we sort of hoping that this is going to be a silver bullet to fix all teen mental health here?
I think there is a little bit of that sense that it's the silver bullet. And I think it's one of the many things in our society that are contributing to difficulties with youth mental health. So I don't think this is going to fix everything, but it's certainly one part of the conversation. And I think that's the important thing, that we've really opened up a conversation and that we hopefully this conversation will keep going, because that issue of kids finding new platforms that perhaps are less safe or looking for options, it's natural at that age to be testing boundaries, to be testing rules, to be building your independence. So we should expect this. We'd be very surprised if adolescents weren't doing this. But having that ongoing conversation with young people and checking in with them is a probably the most important thing that parents and educators can do to support their mental health.
Cam, I'm thinking about all the different people that I've spoken to over the course of this year around this ban, and what I've sort of felt like has been the split is that parents love it and experts hate it. What do you think is going on there?
Yeah, it's actually a good question. Actually, funnily enough, though, I actually think that parents, based on some polling I saw yesterday, are actually slightly less supportive of it than the general population. In fact, there was this weird thing where I noticed that people generally were more supportive of it for other people other than their kids. So interesting kind of dynamic to all of that. But, you know, like there are very clearly a lot of parents who are very concerned about kids and technology. And like, you know, we all went through the pandemic. We were all stuck inside. Everything went online. And I think a lot of people felt uncomfortable about that. A lot of people have seen how their kids are using technology and don't feel very good about that. I think the difference is between kids between parents and the academics is that, you know, like parents always have the kind of anecdotal experience, and you know, that very often it's kind of from their perspective. One thing actually, I'll maybe rather than suggesting you know, saying to myself, I'll say that one thing that kids said in a study about this is that sometimes they feel like parents don't really approach their social media use with a lot of nuance, that they only see the downsides, how it that's bad for them, but they don't really acknowledge and understand, you know, how they use the technology, what benefits they get out of it, and what they're losing. And I think, you know, researchers who probably, you know, don't have the emotional attachment always of coming to kids with this, with their own, you know, emotional, like real connection to that versus the kind of like, you know, trying to speak to all of them, yada, yada, yada. Like they maybe get a little bit more of that, or for whatever reason, you know, get that point of view. So I do, like, totally understandable. Academics, I think, are a lot more cautious. You know, they're trying to look at these incredibly complex systems and you know, trying to understand how everything is affecting kids, including technology. So they're definitely kind of slower to make these conclusions. And who knows, maybe in a few years, will have more strong evidence, and that'll show that this ban was overall, you know, more good than harm. But, you know, at the moment, I would say that most of the academics who really study this, who are experts in this, say they are kind of worried that we don't have really strong evidence supporting that just getting rid of this will have an overall benefit versus, say, not the alternative, which is like doing nothing, but other regulatory efforts that might, for example, blunt some of the harmful features of social media while keeping access to some of the good parts of it.
I do want to put that to Alina in just a tick. But first, Cam, I think one of the criticisms of the ban has been that instead of blocking kids off social media because they're not safe for kids, which is the argument, we should have made a safer internet for everyone. For all of us as internet users, how is the mood going to shift on these spaces if they are meant to be effectively adult-only spaces now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just, you know, like one of the criticisms of this law is that it is kind of just focused on kids rather than these harmful features that everyone has. But, you know, that we're kind of mostly worried about when it comes to kids. And we kind of acknowledge that kids have a little bit, you know, honestly, like, you know, fewer freedoms because of the restrictions that we place on them to keep them safe. And so, you know, there's in all areas of policy, there's always this debate over the difference between what we do for kids and what we do for adults. I think that, you know, for example, example, there's this campaign that's come up recently from the group Teach Us Consent, which is called Fix Our Feed, which says we want to make it so that, you know, algorithmic feeds, you know, those kinds of things that serve you videos based on recommendations and that kind of stuff will actually opt out of that for people, and you've got to opt into it. So this idea of, can we change some of the features in these apps rather than just saying, no matter what you do, we think they're harmful and get rid of them. So, you know, there are kind of different approaches, and maybe there is, and you know, there have been other regulatory efforts that are doing this as well. But obviously this ban has come in, it's taken up all this conversation and oxygen, and that's what we're focusing on. And I think the fear is that, you know, when this is done, people will think that this is problem solved. I think kind of everyone agrees who's really paying attention to this, that, you know, this is an ongoing issue. You know, even if the ban is, it works really well, it'll probably need tweaking. So I hope that people kind of keep paying attention to this.
On ABC Radio National, this is Life Matters. I'm Tegan Taylor with Cam Wilson and Professor Alina Morovska talking about the social media ban that's coming into effect tomorrow for under 18s. I did make a comment before that I feel like most parents that I speak to are fans of the ban. One person says, I'm a parent, I'm not a fan of the ban. Robin in Avalon Beach says, I think adults should be reminded that helping a young person get around the social media restrictions means assuming responsibility for that person's online safety. Well, Alina, we heard Cam say before that experts were not sure there was enough data on the mental health benefit of banning social media. I know that's not the core of your research area, but from what you know of the research, what's your take there?
Yeah, look, as I said before, I think the research is still emerging on this, but there is increasing data showing that social media does have that negative effect on young people. Now, as I said before, that's at a population level. If you look at any individual child, and this is the difference between the anecdote, you know, the person you've heard about, the person you know, your own kids, versus the population of all children or all adolescents in the community. So when we look at that population level, it does certainly seem that excessive social media use, and particularly certain, you know, more risky types of social media use, do result in more difficulties with mental or more mental health problems. So I think if we think about this as a population health approach, in the same way that we protect kids and have rules around, say, driving, you know, we don't allow kids to start driving, and we until they reach a particular age, we do the same things with alcohol. We do the same sorts of things with many, many other things, which is not to say that you couldn't have a younger child driving if they've got the skills, but we decide as a society that this is not something that's appropriate and we want to protect kids from it. And I think this is the way with the social media ban that's coming into force as well. But to me, I think the critical thing is, like driving, if we say, well, we'll just put the ban in and that's it, that's problem solved, that doesn't address the skills issue. That child that needs to learn to drive has a whole program and a whole process in place to help them learn how to drive safely and be a safe member of the driving community. Well, I think we need to really be doing that as well with the social media and broader online space as well, helping kids and parents navigate how to learn the skills to do that safely in a healthy way.
How do we do that? What kind of programs need to sit around this ban so that when kids are 16 and the gates open, that they're able to navigate that safely?
So I think we need probably multiple layers of things over time. So it's not something that should happen, you know, when they're 15 and a half. It needs to be happening right through their education, where kids are learning skills to navigate that through the education system. But we also need to have systems and programs in place for parents, such as the Triple P Positive Parenting Program, which has just released a module for parents on navigating screen use, that really helps parents and kids to have those conversations and to build those skills in children as to how to do that well.
As a parent, if your kid's waking up tomorrow morning and be like, Mom, my social media is gone and I'm sad about it, like, what kind of conversations can parents be having around the country today, tomorrow, in a month's time to help kids navigate this?
Look, I think the most important thing is to acknowledge that for some kids this is a really big deal. So while for the parent or the adult it might feel like, oh, well, you know, what's the big deal here? For some adolescents this is a huge deal. And so acknowledging those emotions and acknowledging those feelings as a starting point is really important. And then helping them navigate, well, what happens next? You know, if the issue is, you know, trying to understand where the problem lies. So is it about missed connections with peers or opportunities for connection with others. If that's the issue, well, then what do you need to do to replace that? How do you build up new ways of engaging and communicating with your friends to replace what you might have had in social media spaces beforehand?
Alina, Cam, thank you both so much for joining me today. Professor Alina Morovska is with the Parenting and Family Support Centre at UQ's School of Psychology. Cam Wilson is tech reporter at Crikey. And thank you for your texts as well. One person says, Roblox thinks my 14-year-old daughter is 18 and we can't seem to change it. We need a photo ID, but she needs to be 16 to get an ID. That's a real Gordian knot you've got yourself in there. Another says banning phones from schools does so much more than the social media ban. Another says sometimes parenting means saying no to your kids. Social media and excessive, the text says screen time, which I think is telling, are hurting our children. Strongly in favour of the ban. This person signs off, mother of four under 10. Thoughts and prayers to you, ma'am. Another says the 10 and 11-year-old boys next door have been riding their bikes a lot around the park opposite us. Their grandmother told me that since they were booted off TikTok, they spend all their time outside. Sometimes, she said, she would find them scrolling TikTok at 3 a.m. So I think the media ban is pretty good for 11-year-old boys. Well, coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, it is nearly holiday time, I hope, for you. How do you manage when you have different expectations than your travelling buddies?
What happens when medicine is sold like a makeover?
Their marketing is very good.
Clinics with five-star reviews selling miracle cures.
I left that place thinking I found myself a solution.
But it's your body that pays the price.
I had one cheek higher than the other, one cheek further out from my nose.
Before and After, a new series on how medical hype spreads online, who profits and who pays. Search for Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been gearing up for your holiday all year. Finally, the day is here. The tickets are booked. The bags are packed. You've even picked out your outfit for the plane. And then a conversation with your travel companion kind of derails your excitement. When you arrive at your destination, you want to go out at night and have fun, but they plan to spend days by the pool and nights resting in the villa. How do you manage different expectations of your holiday? This week, we're going to take a look at the case of a fun-loving traveller who wants to meet men and go on dates when she's away, and it's annoying the friends she's on holiday with. If this is something you've battled and you have advice for our traveller, I want you to weigh in, but our professional advice giver is here. It is Life Matters resident psychologist, Christine Bagley-Jones. She joins me fortnightly for Head and Heart. Christine, I don't know why I didn't become a professional advice giver. It's an amazing calling for you.
I absolutely love it. In fact, people wish I probably did a little bit less of it at home.
Christine, you've come to us this week with a patient's quandary. Has she said okay to you sharing this with the whole country?
She absolutely has. And we've changed just enough of the information so that she's completely protected. But she was really excited to hear that I thought that this would spark a great conversation because it's very familiar.
Okay, tell me the story.
So she went overseas with some friends, some girlfriends who she's travelled with in the past, and they're long-term in terms of their bond. And when she got overseas, she said, hey, look, I want to continue on the apps. I want to meet some guys while I'm away. And she was surprised to hear how frustrated they were with the information and how it then became another issue for her to juggle while she was away, managing their disappointments and still being able to go out and date.
What kind of response did she get from her mates?
Well, firstly, they were surprised. They were like, why do you have to do this overseas? We don't understand. And plus also, aren't you here for us? And so there was a real mismatch in terms of what they wanted to get from the trip versus what she was hoping to get. And I guess there just wasn't clarity around those expectations.
So what did she say? Why was she looking for a fling overseas?
Lots of reasons. And this is sort of, I guess, the theme that I hear. Some people, including her, want the the excitement. Like, it's fun. You get to reinvent yourself. It's also a great opportunity for some personal growth because you are pressed up against different experiences. Pardon the pun.
I was like, okay, Christine.
And it helps sort of ignite ideas around your personal growth and who you are. But it's also really wonderful in terms of cultural immersion because you're seeing the city through the eyes of a local. And for her in particular, she has been avidly dating in Brisbane and not getting a lot of luck. And she wants to meet a special person. So her mind was, maybe if I expand the pond, I'll increase my chances. So her motivations were reasonable, in my opinion.
Okay, I'm putting myself in her mate's shoes. And if I was looking forward to going on holiday with my girlfriends all year, and then one of them was like, bye, I'm going to meet boys, I would be like, sorry, I thought you loved me.
Yes. And I think that's, you've hit the nail on the head. They personalize it. And a lot of things come up in terms of the friendship. Maybe she's a repeat offender in this way, or perhaps the people are having personal experiences themselves, their attachment style. If they say have an anxious attachment style, this could trigger a lot of those feelings of abandonment. There's also that case of projection. It's like, well, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that to a friend. I really adhere to the sisters before misters code. So when it's breached, they really feel offended because at the end of the day, they're maybe taking it more personally than they need to.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking with Christine Bagley-Jones. She joins me fortnightly for Head and Heart. And today we are talking about a scenario that came to Christine in the real life clinic. And her patient has very kindly allowed us to air these grievances on the air nationally. I'd love to know if you've ever run into this problem in your own friendship group where you have travelled with someone and you have different expectations of what the holiday would be. Maybe you just want to chill and they want to go hiking all the time, or maybe you want to have some friendship time and they are really interested in going out and meeting potential lovers, which is the situation that Christine's patient found herself in. You can text us on 0418 226 576. One person text saying, ha ha ha, I preempted this problem. I split my holiday in half. Christmas with the family and a solo holiday the week after for New Year's by myself. If you can afford that, that's great, Christine.
Oh, I love it. And she thought ahead. And you can do that. You can do a hybrid within your holidays with your mates. You can actually say, look, what do we all want to do? And at the onset, have solo time where you say, because, you know, everyone wants to do, not everyone's the same. So some people might be avid art buffs, so they want to go to every single art exhibition they can get their hands on. Someone else might want to tap all the vintage stores. So it's perfectly reasonable. I think it's just a bit more controversial when it's like the online dating field and it's fraught with all of, you know, the perceptions that we have around that and trying to decide if, you know, it feels more personal, you're rejecting me when you go do that with another person versus if you go and rummage through secondhand clothes. But everyone should be entitled to do their thing as long as it's made explicit at the onset.
So when your person was telling you this story, what kind of advice are you giving in that moment?
I think the first thing is try to understand within yourself, like, what's going on? Why do I want to do this now? Am I maybe seeking a dopamine hit or validation, and the short-term gains won't justify the long-term pain of maybe having a disconnect with my friends and make them not feel as important and miss out on that cohesion that occurs, that bonding that happens when a holiday goes well? Then I would also invite her to sit with her friends and have a frank conversation and say, what do you want? These are what I have in mind, and make sure there's alignment and clarity and everyone gets to air what they like so that you can find that balance, that everyone gets to have the holiday they desire, and don't be defensive about it and be flexible. Like, at the end of the day, if they say, look, this really hurts and we really feel it's going to weigh us down, is there another way? Then be open-minded about it.
On the text line, Dean says, as a group, ask a group in advance, what are the holiday things that are important to each person? We begin with the end in mind. Then we can factor in each of the elements into the holidays if possible. It also allows everyone to know what parts of the holidays are important to others and to accept and nurture those aspects. And Dean says, great topic. Well, Christine, I have to know, what happened? Have you had a follow-up with this person yet? Did you hear what she was able to do with her mates?
Yeah, I mean, the friendships are still intact, thank heavens, and I believe that they'll be travelling again in the future. She did meet someone.
Oh,
She did. And I won't go into the details of how it occurred, but they're still in touch.
Okay.
So, you know, you got to be in it to win it. And that's the other thing. I feel like she could have taken the whole experience from a different angle and got all of the girls involved in the project of dating. And so even though they're not interested in going out, they can, you know, want to meet with her for breakfast and hear all about how it went and get excited about the idea of her meeting her special person, which was her main goal, as well as the cultural experience. So it'd be nice if it was more of a team effort where everyone felt included, because then it could be used as a bonding tool.
So if you haven't gone on your holiday yet, this is perhaps a thing for you. What's the way into this conversation?
I think, firstly, offer reassurance, like let them know that, you know, first and foremost is the friendship and the shared experience. And then within that framework, let's all talk about what we want to get out of it and make sure it is aligned with our values, both as a friend and as an individual trying to explore the world and their own identity. And then have many robust conversations, because the problem is when you're on holidays, tension is usually amplified because we don't have the creature comforts of home, other people to talk to, our own personal space, our routine. So it becomes this melting pot for stress. And I really encourage that we try to do as much of a preemptive strike before you've done the long haul flight and then realizing you're in a muddle and trying to tease it out while you're already stressed and in close quarters.
We should all be so lucky to be going on a long haul flight with our mates these holidays. But if you're going to do it, you might as well do it right. Christine, thank you so much for joining me.
Absolute pleasure, Tegan.
Resident psychologist Christine Bagley-Jones joins me fortnightly for Head and Heart. Thank you for your advice as well. Anne says, best advice, go with a larger group. Hopefully you'll always find someone who likes stuff that you want to do. Stick with me here on ABC Radio National, Life Matters. We spoke earlier on the show with eSafety Commissioner Julie Inman-Grant about the social media ban that's coming into effect tomorrow for people under the age of 16. Julie Inman-Grant is, of course, the driving force behind the ban. She's also the mum of three teenagers, so she's having the same conversations with her teens as you are. Here's a little bit of what she said to me earlier.
Well, I've got a little bit of a laboratory here to kind of, I guess, gauge the entire national sentiment. I have an older teenager who said, why wasn't this in place when I was struggling all those years and coming up against bullying and having all these unrealistic expectations? And I have boy, girl, 13-year-old twins. And so they're right in the sweet spot. They've just gotten used to using social media on a regular basis after saying that they were the only kids in the entire country who didn't have a smartphone. My son's pretty unfazed, but it's really distressing for my 13-year-old daughter, who feels like she's built her social life and a lot of her world around social media. And I think this will probably be representative of the broader population in that some kids will struggle with the transition and some will do so more seamlessly. And part of that has to do with the parental scaffolding and support we provide, but also the strategies that they undertake to prepare for this, doing things like making sure that they're setting up group messenger or WhatsApp chats with friends or exchanging phone numbers. I was asked yesterday if it was too insurmountable for kids to share phone numbers because they didn't know them. And I didn't think that that was probably something that they couldn't overcome.
That is, of course, eSafety Commissioner Julie Inman-Grant talking to me earlier in the show. Go back and listen to the full chat I had with her, and also the second chat that I had this morning with a parenting psychologist and a tech reporter about just some of the practicalities of the ban that's coming into effect tomorrow. Both of those stories will be on the ABC Listen app later this morning. You just search Life Matters. Make sure you hit the follow button. That way you can listen to me all the time on the ABC Listen app. That is also something that you sent me heaps of texts about this morning. One person says, thank you for the program. I think the conversation this ban is engendering across the country, which includes young people, is a really interesting opportunity for our society. The conversation covers rights, safety, care, feelings, control and lack of control, the role of government, and more. Chris says, bring on the ban. Most adults are incapable of supervising their children and teens' social media use, kids will deceive them. Thank you so much for your texts on having different expectations of your holidays from your mates who you're traveling with. Ronan says, I have one condition that I tell all my friends every time we holiday together. Anyone on the trip can take a time out at any time for any reason. It creates the space for people to relax on holiday and do their own thing without the pressure to always hang out together. Ronan says it really works. We also spoke about the social media ban for under 16s. One says, as a parent of a child who was bullied using WhatsApp by a group of students at her school, it's concerning to me that we are not banning messaging apps. Another says, given that children and teens will circumvent these bans, it's going to make it exponentially more difficult for schools to detect and deal with online bullying. My concern is that we will further isolate marginalised children. As with many other things in life, careful support to navigate these potentially dangerous spaces safely with the guidance of adults will always be preferable to an abstinence-only policy. Well, that's almost it for Life Matters, coming to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Tomorrow on the show, we will talk about being an upstander, not a bystander. Plus, AI is branching out into comedy. Very curious to see how funny a robot could be. And Dick Van Dyke is going to celebrate his 100th birthday this weekend. So we're going to talk about how you live a century and be healthy and happy about it. That's all on Life Matters tomorrow after 9 a.m. But you can get in touch with me anytime. Just email lifematters@abc.net.au.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.